Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is Tulsa artist Patrick Gordon, also known by the way he signs his canvases as P.S. Gordon, a nationally known artist whose large watercolor still lifes and portraits place him as an important artist in the new American realism school. His work is a part of prominent private, corporate, and museum collections across the United States. Of course, his work is much beloved here at home, and last night he was honored with the Living Arts Living Legend Award. And this evening, he celebrates not one, but two gallery openings. At Living Arts, you can see Mrs. Lennox and the Gift of Falling Snows, which features somewhat unusual subject material done nearly 20 years ago, a series of large portraits featuring men in sumptuous ball gowns, which simultaneously pay homage to 19th century portraitists and symbolic of the health crisis of HIV/AIDS. The second show features his most recent work that's on view at AHA. You can catch him at one of those two galleries tonight during the first Friday art crawl. He'll be making the rounds to both of those galleries. Mrs. Lennox and the Gift of Falling Snow is on display at Living Arts through April. The work at AHA will continue through May 22nd. Patrick Gordon is my guest today. Patrick Gordon, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. It's a pleasure to have you with us, and congratulations on the Living Legend Award.
Thank you very
much. What is your feeling about the Living Legend Award?
Well, sure beats the...
The recently deceased Legend
Award. I'm real happy about it. I think it's a little overwhelming, and I don't believe this stuff. You know, you can't believe what they write about you. You're in trouble. But it's very kind of the city and of Living Arts to do this for me.
Well, your work is much beloved, not only in this city, but around the state as well.
Thank you.
This is the month to see your work. You have two shows this month, one at Living Arts and the other at AHA, featuring recent work. And I'd like to focus on the Living Arts because this is something very different. Well, in many ways, it's very much the same. It has that same P.S. Gordon or Patrick Gordon look, but it's very different material, and that is the Mrs. Lennox series. Tell us about this Mrs. Lennox series.
Well, the interesting part about this show is that I didn't have to rush to make it.
Well, this is
These
what,
paintings
15
were
years
made
ago. 16,
between
17.
20 and 18 years ago, a lot of which has been wrapped in plastic and stored away. I made them for me. They were singly for me. I went to an AIDS fundraiser when we had AIDS fundraisers, and there were two men there dressed in ball gowns, and I couldn't take my eyes off of them. Every time I turned around, there they were, and I finally decided, you're being shown a rare image. It's being shown to me, so I will paint it. So I walked up to them, I didn't know them very well, and asked them if they would please sit for a photo session, and that I'd like to begin a series of paintings about them. They didn't have names at that point. But once I started the photographs, the main figure, who wore a tiara of pearls and his hair was cut, I'd say maybe a 16th of an inch long.
Is this the one with the bright white hair?
Yes.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yes. He bleached what was left there white. And I finally decided that he looked like Annie Lennox's mother, or what I perceived Annie Lennox. Some of you might remember Annie Lennox and the Eurythmics. Mm-hmm. I was pretty convinced that in a theatrical setting, this was Mrs. Lennox, Annie Lennox's mother.
And that's where the series came
from? That's how the series got to be named.
In many ways, it kind of reminds me of the old versions of Queen Elizabeth, in a way. You know, the way the hair was closely cropped.
He has a very regal manner about himself in a Spanish black lace gown that was designed by a man who works in construction and sews like a seamstress who designed the dresses. It was the most fascinating group of people I had met, and I felt the very strong need to document them.
What I love about some of these pieces is there's obvious homages to people like John Singer Sargent and your care in the way he would almost make the dress as much as the portrait person he was doing, the star of his paintings. And there's sort of that sort of care and detail towards this very elaborate, almost from another century piece of clothing. And just the way you set some of these up, they kind of remind me of the way Singer Sargent sometimes would do something that would be a little different from just your average portrait. And
well, that's why I think John Singer Sargent was probably, in my opinion, one of the greatest artists of the 19th century in terms of moving paint around on a canvas. This man knew how to manipulate paint, and he knew how to manipulate the viewer. And I'm hoping that I took some signals from him and studying him for the last 50 years, because there is a Sargent-like quality to these. These were not treated as wild paintings of drag queens.
No.
These are treated as 20th century portraits of men in ball gowns.
Mm-hmm. I know that there's also sort of this social commentary that was a part of it, or was it a part of it?
Oh, no. You can't deny.
I mean, transgender today is pretty mainstream, but
20 years ago, it was not mainstream. Yeah. 20 years ago, people were dying from AIDS. 20 years ago, we were not an organized group. We had spent much of our lives hiding. And I'm sorry, I'm too old to hide. I'm not playing hide and seek. I quit 30 years ago. But it wasn't easy being a gay man in Oklahoma. It wasn't easy being a gay man really anywhere except for East Coast and West Coast. I felt it was important to document these people. And I think looking back now when I see them, and I hope that you will come to see these paintings at Living Arts as well as the paintings that are at AHA, I hope you will see that these really are historical documents about a life and lifestyle and time in America. I don't mean to try and make me sound like I'm the anthropologist of oil painting, because I don't mean it that way. But I do see them 20 years later as being significant paintings of gay America that had never really been shown before, since maybe there was a couple of artists in the 40s who attempted to show it, but it was still very closeted in the work itself.
What's interesting is this is sort of documenting the cusp of a massive social change, too.
Age of Aquarius.
Yeah.
It was the 60s that led into the 70s, and the 70s led into the 80s, and people started getting sick.
Yeah. Now, out of those two first gentlemen that you had posed for you, how many Mrs. Lennox canvases did you do altogether?
Well, altogether, there are nine.
Mm-hmm.
Nine large scale, and I think the largest is 4.5 by 7.5 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Life size figurative paintings. There are a few others besides Mrs. Lennox. There's the dressmaker and the bridesmaid. There was going to be a whole series about a marriage in this, and Mrs. Lennox and Mr. Lennox were going to go on a world tour of the eight wonders of the world. I got the first one done. And Mrs. Lennox in the Garden of Cheops at midnight. And it's...
I love that title.
It's with two pyramids in the background, mostly buried. The background was taken from a Sir David Roberts lithograph done in 1860 when he traveled through Egypt documenting the pharaohs and the temples, and mostly which were still under sand. And I found them so fascinating, and I thought, oh, I can turn this into a night scene. So therefore, we have her at the first.
But at some point, you abandoned that series, I guess.
Well, life changes.
Mm-hmm.
And I took some radical change in my life and ended up moving to New York, where I stayed for 9 years. And I came back 4 years ago.
Yeah.
But to say Mrs. Lennox is dead is not quite right, because I saw somebody last night at the opening, and I thought, oh, I see a painting. So that was fun. I thought I hadn't had one of those creative little moments about that.
So you did this in the late 90s. You made this series. You moved on. You moved to New York. You went up back to other things. Have they just been sitting?
The ones that I had, I sold five of them,
uh-huh.
And then I kept three. I said, I don't want to sell anymore.
But you quit doing them, and had you kind of forgotten about them?
No.
Over?
No. I live with them. I have them framed. And each of the frames are classically 19th century as well. A couple of them are really beautiful Spanish frames with great mullions and beautiful gold leaf. The frames are as important to me as the paintings were.
Well, that was sort of also that 19th century sensibility.
Absolutely.
that you had to have this ornate frame to make this beautiful image even more beautiful. And that was part of the deal.
I was a master at gilding the lily. And that's what the 19th century was about.
Yeah.
But I find them really interesting, and I don't mean that from a vanity standpoint.
So this is not something you did discard, sort of moved on to the next thing, and then you're looking at them freshly anew. You've been living with these pieces.
I live with them. Yeah. Every day I understand what they were for, what they were made about, and that it would be very easy to return to it with the right image presented to me.
Yeah. My guest today is Patrick Gordon, Tulsa's best-known artist. Of course, he has received the Living Arts Living Legend Award last night, and you can see his work in two places. The Mrs. Lennox series we've been talking about, the show is called Mrs. Lennox and the Gift of Falling Snow. That's at Living Arts through April. And the same night, tonight, as a matter of fact, the official openings are occurring for the Living Arts show and a new show at AHA, Recent Work, which will be on display through May 22nd. So we cannot get away from your work this month.
It won't happen again for a long time, I promise.
So tell us a little bit about the AHA work, recent work. You've been working for people who know you for your beautiful floral watercolors. Mm-hmm. You've always worked with oil on and off. But what I've seen in your most recent work has been floral work in oil.
Yes,
a lot
it
of
is.
Floral work in oil.
When I moved to New York, I decided to really make a conscious effort to calm my studio by just primarily doing oil painting. I wasn't thinking too much. I use watercolor as a means to an end when I'm working up concept for a painting through studies. And I still do watercolors. There's a watercolor at AHA that I did in New York. I waited till I got to Tulsa to frame it because of the size. It's 60 tall and 80 wide. That's... And they're paintings of white spider mums. Mm. And people ask me, do you still do watercolor? And I can just send them around the wall to see that, yes, I still do watercolor. I loved watercolor. I could never quit ever painting a watercolor. But I was trained as an oil painter. And when I got to TU, I met Glenn Godsey, and I wanted to paint in watercolor worse than anything in the world, and he really was such a fabulous teacher. He calmed me down, he got me centered, and he said very little to me, but it was an incredible relationship. It still is. We're still friends. But I did watercolor differently than what most people traditionally did with it. And so I tightened it up, and I really made it a very controlled photographic quality. They're not photographs, but they have a photographic quality because I work from photographs.
Photorealism.
Yes. And except I don't see them quite as photographic, even though I know that their original source is photography.
How do you see it differently?
Well, I always think I have the better view, honestly.
Uh-huh.
The photograph was good to start with, but I know how to make it, I think, better. So I just use them as reference and try and improve on them.
I've always been impressed with the watercolor because the watercolor media is so
unforgiving.
Unforgiving and delicate
hateful. You know, when you do watercolor, from the top of a line to the bottom can take less than 3 or 4 seconds. But by the time I get back up to the top, it's already started to dry because it's settled into the paper. Well, that doesn't give you much time to get there. So you have to work fast, and you have to be thinking 2 steps ahead. Now, I was lucky. That part made sense to me. But what didn't make sense to me is that I couldn't get big watercolor paper. And I'm very specific. I like an 1,112-pound cold-press watercolor paper, which is thick, and it doesn't buckle. It doesn't matter how much water you put on it.
It doesn't seep.
It doesn't seep. But it doesn't come
because
in big sheets.
You couldn't do what you do if it seeped at all because,
you could, but it
well,
wouldn't
maybe
be
your
quite
technique,
as...
Yeah.
It wouldn't be quite as good, but
The sharp lines is that's the thing I love about your work. You know, it's just such crisp. A crisp line.
I like crisp.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. But with oil painting, my scale could improve, and I make big paintings. I like the overwhelming size of a big canvas against, and I'm not a little man. When I stand up against a 6 by 6 foot canvas, it's so much bigger than me. And I love the aspect that I'm going to control this. This one 36 square foot section of canvas is mine. It's going to be mine if it kills me. And I like that challenge.
You know, you were talking about the big Spider Mums watercolor. Mm-hmm. This is a silly question, but, you know, as you're getting towards the end of the piece, you've done this huge watercolor. Do you ever worry? It's like, you know, one slip of the hand and the whole thing is toast.
You know, Rich, I really have come to the point in my life where I concede that I don't think there are mistakes. Mm-hmm. If I make a straight line there accidentally, there are no accidents. It's supposed to be there. Mm-hmm. Now, is that kind of woo-woo, I'm going to pass the buck on it? But the reality is, I think it really is true. Maybe that line's supposed to be there.
It's like a jazz musician who might play a clinker, but the clinker, he turns the clinker into a part of his solo.
I always said that part of watercolor, a great deal of watercolor, was hiding the mistakes that I'd made. And people would say, where's the mistake? I said, if you can't see it, then I was successful. You know, the act of painting for me is the joy of my life. I might not like everything I do. I like most of everything I do. But every now and then I get one and I think, well, it's a little flat, or what were you thinking?
What do you do with those? Do you just discard them or set them aside?
I think about them, but I often get them out of my studio and put them in the basement. I have just a basement full of stuff.
Do you ever go back and look? Because, you know, sometimes you can be a harsh critic at the moment, and when you look back at something, you say, well, no.
I try to get them out of my studio as soon as they're done, because if not, I'll have that back on that wall. I recently had a painting from a client, and they said, would you mind storing it for a little while? I said, oh, I wouldn't mind. The more I looked at it, the more I saw something wrong, and it was everything in my life not to touch it, because I could see I was wrong. And I could see it. So if I can see it, somebody else can see it. Anyway, I didn't correct it because I thought they bought it this way. It's not for me to do. Mm. So more than anything, I'm probably learning what my place is in the studio. And it's trying to make me submit. And I have a strong will.
Now, the oils in the show, are they mainly florals,
yes, sir.
Still lifes?
Well, that's not altogether true. I have 5 portraits in it. 4 of the portraits are very small, which is atypical of me. They're small watercolors. 1 is just black watercolor. They look like drawings, but they're just black watercolor. And the other is... And the black watercolors are of my friends in New York that I miss dearly and wish that they were here. And they did come in for the dinner last night, which was sweet. And then the other portraits are my friends Chris and Craig Kallenberger, also a TU graduate. We met in undergraduate school, and we have remained friends since then. And then there is the portrait of my dog. The painting's entitled Rochester Gordon, Accompanied by the Feral Children. Well, the Feral Children are my grandchildren from Philadelphia, and they're just the cutest kids. But I hadn't done a painting of my dog, and I wouldn't do a painting of my dog by himself. But, oh, my God, I put those kids behind him, and I could justify to paint the dog by doing the portrait of my grandchildren. So I'm pretty crazy about my grandkids, but I love my dog.
My guest today is Patrick Gordon. You can see his work in 2 shows in Tulsa, Mrs. Lennox and the Gift of Falling Snows. This is work that was done up to 20 years ago at Living Arts, and that's on display through April. And recent work is at AHA, and that's through May 22nd. Both of them open tonight for the first Friday. How are you going to, you're going to be the traveling artist.
Well, I really wanted to get a golf cart, have signs painted on the side of it that says Living Legend, Living Legend, Living Legend, which I think's funny, but
I do.
I'll be at Living Arts the first hour and a half, and the second hour and a half I will be at the Hardesty Art Center, AHA.
And it'll be a great chance to see some work that really hasn't been seen probably all that much in the Mrs. Lennox, as well as some of the most recent work you're doing. I know you've always been a pretty disciplined artist as far as like every morning going to the... Is that still, at, you know, as you're
maybe
in your 60s you now today? No.
My daughter's grown. I don't have to carpool. I don't have any of that left to do. So there's nothing else left for me to do but paint.
So what's the day like for you?
I start about 9:30. I don't start real fast. I had a friend who was a painter, and she started at 4 in the morning, and I just thought, you're crazy. And I start about 9:30. I paint almost every day and night till 11 o'clock at night. Then I turn it off. As soon as used to be Dave Letterman came on, I immediately turned the TV off and would go paint. I break for lunch. I break for dinner. Mm-hmm. I have no other responsibilities in life except to paint.
Are you working out any new series? I mean, these two shows show two different sides of your work. So
well,
are you still?
I show two different sides because the Mrs. Lennox paintings may not be always easy for all people to see or understand. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want people to think that I had abandoned what I had made a living on and what I love truly, which is to paint flowers. And so I thought, let's run both shows at the same time so nobody goes, oh, he has gone so far over here that I can't understand what he's making, to, oh, I understand this, that there must be a place in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that love of florals, of painting flowers.
Where did it come from?
No. So why, you know, it's been with you all your life.
Mm-hmm.
What keeps you going back for flowers? I mean, you know, the great Dutch masters made their whole life about capturing an arrangement.
Absolutely.
You know, but what is it? What is the challenge and passion for you?
The object itself is so miraculous. The flower, it comes up, it blooms millions, billions of times a year, and each one is perfect. Each one comes up, and they're still perfect. Well, I think what an incredible thing to return in an annual basis. You go through beauty, which is at their height, to mildewed and on the ground, which is their death, and then the reoccurrence. I'm not terribly religious, but there is a spiritual process there that I find amazing. I was introduced very early in my life to flowers. My grandmother, Billy Stallings, was a florist. So at 3, I'd be sticking my head in those refrigerators. It was hot in Claremore. But that refrigerator, no air conditioning in the flower shop, except for the flowers. And I'd stick my head in there, and, oh, they smelled so good, and it was so cold, and it produced an effect that I still, 59 years later, remember as if I close my eyes, I'm there again. I have friends here from New York, and I was telling them, they said something this morning about flowers, and I said, well, how worried do you think my parents were when they found out I had talked the woman across the street into giving me a pink rambling rose bush out of her yard and that I needed to find some place to plant it? And they were like, why did you do that? And I said, well, it's so beautiful. I want it. Well, I'm sure my father was just like, oh, God, what are we going to do? But, you know, they really encouraged me to do exactly what I did.
And we are glad they did that.
I am too.
You can see the results at the Living Arts in AHA. Patrick, thanks very much for joining us
Rich,
again.
It's always good to be here.
Tulsa artist Patrick Gordon speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. You can see his work opening in two places this evening. Mrs. Lennox and the Gift of Falling Snows opens at Living Arts tonight and will be on display through April. And Recent Work opens at AHA and will be on display through May 22nd. Both will have openings tonight as a part of the Brady District's First Friday Arts Crawl. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Today we also remember internationally known architect Zaha Hadid, who died yesterday at the age of 65. She was the first woman to win architecture's Pritzker Prize, and her undulating form of her buildings have inspired a whole new generation of architects. She also had an Oklahoma connection. She was commissioned to design a large expansion to the Price Tower Arts Center. Her design was typically bold and provocative, but sadly was never built. I spoke with her back in 2003. Can you tell us, when you're looking at a space, as you were looking at Bartlesville now, you see the surrounding landscape. What are you looking for when you're beginning the design process?
Well, we kind of try to draw kind of some sort of, let's say, energy from the existing lines which exist in the kind of the city or the landscape. And each case is very different. Over here is trying to kind of really maybe try to reinterpret landscape in an urban context. And I think it's a very interesting combination where you can create a degree of density through landscape, landscape method of designing a space. And therefore, you know, unlike the tower, which is kind of, although not repetitive, but it's kind of a striated sort of condition going to all the way up, this the new museum will be more like a kind of a puzzle of spaces. And that could relate to the landscape maybe adjacent to Bartlesville or which streams through it, and the light is really stunning here. And so we try to kind of really make a mostly top-lit galleries because it could take advantage of the light in the city.
Yeah. What is special about the light?
I guess I'm not really a describer. It's kind of a very beautiful light here because it expands. I mean, you know, those of us who live in London, you know, hardly see a sky.
That's right.
You know, it's always striking how big the sky is here. And that's true of many American cities, but here in particular, it's a really wonderful light.
We have this just little, the very small urban area outside, you know, just you drive 5 minutes and you're in the prairie.
That's right, yeah. And it struck me that I got here that it's kind of the beauty of the prairie land, and it's really lovely.
You were talking about creating a puzzle of space, and I found that succinctly describes quite a few of your museum projects.
Right. Well, not all of them. I think that, yeah. You know, but the idea was to create a space which is fluid and then you move from one to the other seamlessly. And also in that journey, that spatial experience is an added experience to this museum space, to any public space. Because I think it's one thing to kind of really satisfying the program, but I think you have to go to give the visitor an extra experience or a child experience, let's say. And that could be done instead of really stacking them up. The way they are, the adjacency becomes very interesting, you know, and mm-hmm. and you might be able to see from one gallery to the next through the way you cut holes in the side, or you need to you have different kind of really conditions.
Iraqi British architect Zaha Hadid died yesterday at the age of 65. That was her speaking with us back in 2003. At Studio Tulsa for today, our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.